Tonight on Arena, we can't go to theatre, but Cora Cadorca can bring theatre to us. And Eva Welch's new novel about Elizabeth Bone's wartime romance with a Canadian diplomat. Five one double 51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Well, if you live in Cork, there's something very exciting coming to a green space near you soon. Faced with the challenge of COVID restrictions, Cora Cadorca, the Cork-based theatre company, has come up with an exciting live theatre piece for the Cork Midsummer Festival. The show is called Contact, a travelling theatre performance. And joining me now in the line is the artistic director of Cora Cadorca, Pat Kiernan, and playwright and one of the performers in this new piece, Aideen O'Donoghue. Pat, I'll start with you. Anybody who knows Cora Cadorca and your work will know that you're definitely a company that thrives on making theatre outside of the confines of any building, of any theatrical space. Yeah. I thought, yeah, the virus will put a challenge up to Cora Cadorca, but you didn't want to go down the online route.
No, well, not immediately. I mean, we have something in the pipeline for that also. But I suppose I was kind of excited and interested in the idea of, you know, quickly and suddenly what theatre can do to make something within the restrictions and finding a theatricality in that, you know.
And with a title like Contact, it seems as if it's absolutely made for these times. I presume you're making some kind of commentary around the lack of contact that we currently have or can have.
Yeah, or the difficulty, or I suppose importantly, what kind of contact can you make within the restrictions, you know, when it's not, you can't be tactile or, you know, I think we've all witnessed so many images of people trying to make contact with people through glass or perspex, you know, through solid surfaces. So just the idea of that. I mean, we're very kind of, I think we're being quite playful with it as well, and that it's kind of trying to attain the theatricality of those conditions.
And let me ask Aideen a little bit about the specifics of the piece itself, Aideen. It's yourself and one other performer that's involved in this. One of the lads from
Cormac Mullally, from
Lords of Strutt. So, is there contact between the two of you? How are you working things in a socially safe, distanced way?
Well, I suppose the two characters that we're playing, they're kind of created by this experience that the world is going through. So they want to make contact, and it's I guess it's a kind of a joyful meditation or homage to the new ways that we're finding to connect with each other. So we can't touch, and we really want to, you know, just reach out and hold one another, but we simply can't do that. And the piece is kind of, I guess, joyful and positive, and it's just trying to show the power of the longing for human connection and that relationship.
And it was today was the first day of actual rehearsals, or you're very early in the rehearsal process. So how unusual was it? I think there's just four of you in the room now, a two-hander,
yes.
I suppose. There'd be a small group anyway, but four of you in the room, and all the time this awareness of social distances that have to be kept.
Yeah, well, we've done an awful lot of workshopping and talking and troubleshooting on Zoom, which has been like highly unusual, but a really interesting way to conceive what we might do, and talking about those ideas before being in a space together and trying things out. So today was the first kind of in-person rehearsal. So it's been quite an interesting experience to create something artistic virtually online and then see if it works in our first day of rehearsal today.
Yeah, so the whole new world, the brave new world that we live in now, you have Zoom rehearsals before actual rehearsals, then you have actual rehearsals.
Exactly. And, you know, it kind of provokes a new way of working, and, you know, we want to keep making art and keep making theatre, so we have to adapt, and that's what creatives do, really. So yeah. It's a good challenge.
I said at the very top in my menu, at the top of the programme, Pat Kiernan of Cork and Dorcas Theatre Company, if we can't go to the theatre at the moment because the theatres are all closed and it's an inside space, and there are way too many difficulties that have to be ironed out with all of that yet. And I said, well, if you can't go to theatre, Cork and Dorcas will bring theatre to you. This for me is one of the real joys of this piece. Explain where you're going to do it and how that's going to work.
Well, what we're going to do is that we're presenting it as part of the Cork Midsummer Festival, because initially we were supposed to be producing Aideen's play, which was going to be in our small studio space, which obviously we began to learn it wasn't going to happen. So we began to think about, you know, outside of the practicalities and guidelines of people not being able to go into spaces, I think we're conscious also of the idea that there's a nervousness of gathering with other people also. So the idea that we bring it to greens around the city, we're going to bring them to 16 different greens. And when I say greens, like housing estate greens that are surrounded by houses that have access for us for our vehicles, and for the most part, we'll be travelling independently, that we make and find hopefully a theatricality in the setup of this as well with our crew. So this ordinary green space that it's transformed with, you know, with the construction of a set, the installation of an LED wire-free lighting system, that idea will transform the place. Then the actors come in, and then the piece that we are making will happen there, and then the crew will disassemble the piece in view of our audience. You can watch it from your garden, your bedroom window, your living room window, maybe you can step outside the hedge, but that it's basically theatre in the round in housing estates.
I mean, that's the amazing thing, that literally people can, if whatever they feel comfortable with all the time, it will be within the guidelines. But if they want to stay within the confines of their own house, look out the window, open the window and watch that way, they can do that. Yeah. If they want to step into the garden, they can do that, whatever way they want to do it, which tells us something, Aideen, I think, about the nature of the piece. It's not going to be full of verbal puns and subtle lines of dialogue. It's going to have to be big, broad, physical work that can be seen at a distance.
Exactly, yeah. We have to, I guess, develop a kind of a visual language that people will be able to understand. Yeah, exactly, at a distance. So that's what we're working at the moment. It's going to be very exciting.
And are you thinking of these characters, you know, do they have names? Do they have a specific story? Or are you trying to make them that they can read as whoever you want them to read as?
I guess my approach to the character is that I'm playing is that she is born of this moment. So the way I see it is, I don't see her as having this, you know, big psychological backstory, but that she's completely unfazed by these new measures that are molding her life. They're normal. I hate the phrase, but they are the new normal. But she's adapting to them and making the very best that she can out of her situation. And I guess I have to try and transmit that to the audience through my body language and my face and movement and all of that kind of thing, that they'll be able to understand where she's coming from without text, basically, or without being very close to her.
Yeah, without verbal cues, that the visual aspect will be enough to do just that. Pat mentioned there that there had been plans to put on a play of yours. What stage were you at with the work when the play was called Hail to the Great Wave? What stage were you at when you found out, no, this isn't going to happen right now?
Pretty close to finishing, I guess, maybe a final draft, or maybe I'll do another draft, I don't know, but pretty close to the end. And I was in lockdown when we were doing our workshop online on Zoom. So I was writing and about a kind of apocalyptic play when the apocalypse was happening. So that was a very interesting experience. So it was, I think, in mid-March that we got the announcement. And I was writing in March with a view to do our workshop at the end of the month. So it was all very unexpected, but the play will happen at some point, but we're not sure when or how that might happen because we don't know the circumstances yet. But yeah, we don't know what's going to happen exactly.
Yeah, what struck me too was the actual idea of the play. As you said, it's apocalypse has happened in terms of the play that you had written. It's a couple in a bunker.
I'm sorry, I can't quite hear you there. Would you be able to say that again?
Yes, I was just saying that. The play itself, that it deals with this couple in a bunker about to have a baby. So, I mean, there was something about the claustrophobia and the isolation of that that fits right into the situation we're in right now.
Yes, it was. So I started writing it about a year ago, and I thought I was being very clever, thinking of something completely new that would never happen.
Oh, we seem to have lost Aideen there. I'll come back to you, Pat, in fact, just about the general situation that we're all having to deal with at this point in time, Pat. Where do you think this is going to lead to for theatre companies, practitioners like yourself? Very, very difficult for people who are relying on theatre for a living.
Yeah, well, I suppose it's going to come down to the see where it fits in, actually, into the nation, really, you know. Because it's going to take a little bit of minding, I think, now, you know. And I think it's going to take a lot of creativity and new ideas. You know, I think venues particularly, I mean, you know, we're in the luxurious position of used to, you know, that we're not tied to a venue and that we're, you know, that we're not necessarily dependent on being in venues, but people who are, it's an extraordinarily difficult time. We may need to start thinking about new experiences, but what might the new theatre experience be or new live experience be? But look, the biggest thing is none of us know really, do we? But I think it's the arts needs to be looked after now, you know, and I know that there has been, you know, in terms of the national campaign for the arts, that they're working really hard in ensuring that we as an industry don't become sidelined as the inevitable recession comes on, you know.
And have you spoken to other theatre makers, other production companies, not only in Cork but around the country? Are you getting a sense of what sense are you getting from them?
Well, I mean, it's the same. I mean, you know, I mean, ultimately, okay, I mean, it's been gradual in some ways, insofar as that we're going, okay, well, are things going to change? Are they going to, you know, in terms of the arts concert, we all have to relook at our plans that were made last year or the year before that, which suddenly became redundant for most of us, you know. There's the optimist in us is seeing things going back to a way or a place that allows audiences to gather in buildings again. I think the pessimists in us are seeing that as a long way off yet.
Yeah.
But the thing I'll say to everybody is that usually there's something going on. There's somebody you can ring up to say, what's actually going on? None of us can, you know?
Yeah, nobody has the inside track on this one.
No.
Well, listen, Pat, thanks for speaking to us and joining us this evening, and also to Aideen O'Donoghue speaking to us earlier there. And the show that Pat and Aideen were telling us about, Contact, a travelling theatre performance by Kirk O'Dorker, can be seen from the 11th through until the 14th of June and the 18th through until the 21st of June at various locations, maybe outside your window, hopefully, around Cork City. But you can find out full details of all of that on corkmidsummer.com. Bark, and that's Bark spelt B-A-R-Q, are an Irish four-piece whose music has been described as agro-soul. The band comprises musicians Neil Durrington, Stephen McHale and Tommy Gray and singer Jess Cab. Their latest single is called Dive. It'll be released on this Friday, June the 5th. But let's listen to a sneak preview right now. And that's a song called Dive, which is the latest single from Irish agro soul four-piece Bark. The Last Day at Bowen's Court is a new novel from Ava Welsh. It explores a key relationship in the life of Elizabeth Bowen, a writer who divided her time between Cork and London. A wartime romance with a Canadian diplomat that neither party ever forgot, and that went on to inspire one of Bowen's most acclaimed novels, The Heat of the Day. Ava Welsh joins me now on the line. This is a work of fiction, this new work, Ava, but you work in literary criticism as well, very much so in your academic life. And Elizabeth Bowen has been very important in terms of that literary criticism. What stands out about her for you before we talk about this novel?
That's a very good question. Like, what has always appealed to me about her? Just the quality of the writing, the sort of classicism, the invention. I suppose the poetic quality of her prose and of her description. I think once you read something by Bowen, a description of a house, a person, a child, everything, it always lingers in your mind. So really it was the quality of the writing for always inspired me. And she said that fiction was the poetic expression, or the non-poetic expression of a poetic truth. So it's really admiration for her as novelist, short story writer and memoir writer.
So there you go. You set yourself quite a task then when you have someone whose writing you think has that quality that you're now going to fictionalise an aspect of her life. And you talk about getting using non-poetic expression to find a poetic truth. What was it about the academic expression that wasn't getting to the truth? Did you want to get somewhere else by going into the world of fiction here?
Yes, because it's easier. you can say what you want in a novel, and you can make things up and you can invent. And I always thought, well, how did she do it? How did she manage to publish a novel dedicated to her lover while still living with her husband and continue to live with her husband in the year that her lover gets married? So I thought, behind this wonderful writing is a life, a very rich and undoubtedly complex life. And I think I felt I could, I mean, it sounds very audacious even to attempt it, but it's fiction. It's my imagining of how, behind the scenes, I suppose, she negotiated her life.
You do know you've set yourself up now, having said to novelists that it's a lot easier to write a novel than it is to write literary criticism. You could find yourself in deep trouble now, ever.
Hopefully, Sean, with any luck. I feel a heated debate coming on, as Mrs. Merton would say.
Let's just lay out, I suppose, I saw the lovely term, I think you used it, in fact, in your Irish Times article, a love rectangle that's involved here. Elizabeth Bowen and her husband, Alan Cameron, and then the diplomatic Charles Ritchie. And was it his cousin that he married, Sylvia Ritchie?
Indeed, she was his cousin, and she had been very much part of his life. And indeed, Elizabeth's own life, she had known her. But the actual wedding itself came as an enormous shock to Elizabeth. And it's recorded for nearly 20, 25 years. She didn't want to meet her again. She didn't want to have anything to do with her. So, I mean, one of the things I started thinking about was, what was it like to be Sylvia Ritchie? You know, you just get married to your cousin, and this novel comes out, which is dedicated to your husband. And actually, it's about the love affair he has with one of the most celebrated writers of the time. So that's one of the things I've tried to imagine in my novel.
And it is, I mean, it is a well-known romance, this Bowen-Ritchie situation. Has it been written about much before, even in critical terms, and on how it might have fed into Bowen's work? Or was this, were you finding a totally new tack on Bowen's work by doing this work of fiction?
No, I mean, everybody knew, and I was lucky to meet people who knew her, and they were very fond of her husband, and they were very fond of Charles Ritchie, very fond of him. He was an established part of her life. And there's a wonderful book called Love's Civil War, which is Bowen's letters to Ritchie and Ritchie's own diaries. And we have, you know, in her fiction, I think, we have an account of their love affair in The Heat of the Day. And throughout their work, throughout both of their writings, there is a very strong acknowledgement of this, and he was there right to the end. What we don't have is Alan Cameron's version or Sylvia Ritchie's version, and I've just made it up. I mean, I don't know what they really thought, but I tried to imagine it. So I gave them a chapter each, as well as giving both Elizabeth and Charles sort of alternate chapters.
And Alan Cameron, and again, I'm confused now in my own head as to whether this is within the diaries or within the reality or within your novel. Alan Cameron kind of grudgingly came to accept Charles Ritchie almost as a pal towards the end of this period.
That's my sense of it. And I think one biographer records the fact that there was a nice, quite nice framed photograph of Charles Ritchie in Bowen's apartment that she lived with her husband, and he was a regular visitor to their house, so nothing was hidden. And I mean, I imagined the two men getting on reasonably well and understanding the nature of their relationship with this kind of central figure in their lives. And that's one of the things I try and imagine, the way in which these things were negotiated, because nothing like that is easy. It might look easy, but it isn't. It can't be. And I suppose that's what I wanted to try and tease out. It's my version of it. It may be completely wrong, but as I said, it's a novel. It's made up.
And you clearly have enjoyed that making up process greatly, Eva. But I'm wondering about, you did go, you travelled, you looked at that book of letters, the letters of Elizabeth Bowen, you looked at the diaries of Charles Ritchie. But yet within the book itself, we certainly get made up letters on the part of Bowen and Ritchie. The academic in you, did you just have to put him to the one side and say, forget about the footnote here now, mister. You're not going to get anything like that. You're going to make this up, and you're not going to worry about what people think about that.
Absolutely. You have to give yourself permission. When you're writing historical fiction, which I suppose this is, although their lives are very near to ours, you have to be a researcher and you have to be a historian and literary critic, and then you have to stop. And then the novelist or the storyteller or the writer has to take over. And one thing I did, which is that apart from the four main characters, everybody else is invented. And that's really to give it a kind of, I suppose, an atmosphere of fiction. I invent all the minor characters and only the four main characters. And as you say, Sean, I invent letters and obviously conversations that nobody knows what they were. And I had to leave all that behind and try and imagine myself into their world. And I found it immensely pleasurable and actually quite painful as well. At crucial moments, I felt very sorry for all of them and immensely connected to the lives that all four lived. I mean, four adults that had to make their way in a world that kind of compromised each of them, you know.
The other thing that I think is important is, can I just check on the dates of it? Because the novel that you give us is very much a wartime novel. But in reality, did Ritchie and Bowen actually meet? Was it after the war? After the Second World War? They weren't met during the war, did they?
During the war. I mean, I did change some things, but no, they met right in the war. And theirs was very much a wartime love affair. And she always felt that they kind of lived in an imaginative world that was created by the London, the Blitz. And of course, this was the thing that I had never envisaged. When my book came out, when I got a wonderful copy, it's beautifully produced and put together and presented. I found myself like reading it in the first few weeks in a very similar world to the one I was trying to imagine. A world where the normal had fled. And as Bowen said, they now lived in a world of lucid abnormality. So the war, London, the Blitz, was crucial to their meeting. And bizarrely, and so strangely, when I came to read the novel now in the last few weeks, you know, to me there are all sorts of parallels between those worlds and the world we find ourselves in.
The novel, the Heat of the Day, Bowen's actual novel, The Heat of the Day, is part of the story here as well. And as you say, she dedicated that to Ritchie. You give us a great scene where Ritchie's wife, Sylvia, reacts to that dedication in a not very nice way, perhaps, and totally understandably so. What are the parallels between the story that's told in The Heat of the Day, do you think, and the Charles Ritchie-Elizabeth Bowen affair? Because you suggest here that, in fact, this affair was very much, it very much informed the story that Bowen told in her greatest novel.
Yes, I think it really did inform. In The Heat of the Day, we have a central character called Stella, and she falls in love with a man called Robert Kelway. And the novel is about spying, which is something, you know, Bowen understood and was very interested in. And the love affair has an intensity created by the landscape of war. And I don't want to give away the ending of The Heat of the Day. It's a wonderful novel, but it has many twists and turns and quite a tragic kind of denouement. And I wondered about Bowen using her own love affair to create the central characters, but then moving it in an entirely different direction. And my central interest in the novel, my novel, is Bowen being unable to finish her wartime novel, that Charles has got married to his cousin. And it's about her reclaiming, I suppose, that imaginative space that they found themselves in together, which was London during the Blitz. So the two novels, my novel and Bowen's novel and her affair, they're all interconnected. I mean, I would like to say, said he in the interest of selling the book, you don't have to have read Bowen to follow it. If you like her work, I hope you'll enjoy the parallels. And I mean, I really plundered her work to sort of her own fiction to fill out what I wanted to imagine as her life. But if you do like Bowen, I hope you'll enjoy the novel. But you don't have to have read it to follow my novel.
Given that you're saying that effectively, if there was a thesis in a work of fiction, the thesis of this book is that it was this love affair between Elizabeth Bowen and Charles Ritchie that informed The Heat of the Day. Was that something she commonly did in her other works? That's asking you, I suppose, the literary critic to answer that one.
Yes, I mean her work, like The Last September, which we know, her very famous novel, very much based on her family home, Bowen's Court, in North Cork. Her most popular novel, The Death of the Heart, she based it in the house that she lived in on Clarence Terrace, the one I talk about, in Regent's Park. So Bowen was always drawing upon the landscape of her own life to make her novels. And yeah, she very much drew upon her relationship with Charles Ritchie and her experience of war. And then what I do is I use some of her stories and some passages from her novels to actually fill out what we don't know. Like she and Charles Ritchie wander out into Regent's Park at night, a kind of moonlit night during the Blitz. That's taken from one of her stories, one of her most brilliant wartime stories. So Bowen borrowed from her life to make her novels, and I'm borrowing from her novels to kind of make up her life as much as I can.
We talk about, you say you invented lots of the kind of side characters, if you like, and that the immediate four, Elizabeth Bowen, her husband Alan Cameron, and the two Ritchies, Charles and Sylvia, they are real people. The fifth character in the book undoubtedly is there in the title, The Last Day at Bowen's Court. How important was and is that family home?
It's hugely important. It became the symbol of their relationship. And I introduce it as a miserable place that they drive up to one wet early summer day evening, as only a wet day in Ireland in May can be. But it actually became, Ritchie fell in love with the home and with the landscape around there. And I think that's a very good way of putting it. I hadn't thought about that before, but the house is the fifth character. And they never, I mean, it's always eluding them. The house has always sort of escaping them. They managed a lifetime relationship, hardly living in the same place, the same city. And I think they always had, both of them always had this dream that they'd go back to Bowen's Court, that it would be her home. And I begin and end the novel with Charles Ritchie on his deathbed, longing for her and longing for her house and the light around the house in North Cork, the beautiful landscape around Farahy.
So from now out then, Eva Welsh, is it the easy route, the novel route, rather than that old tedious research and backing it up with footnotes, etc.? Are you going to stick to the fiction, or is there still more literary criticism to come?
Well, as we speak, I'm correcting an index for a fantastic new book I'm bringing out, The Collected Writings of Jane and William Wilde. Isn't that a book you'd like to read?
Well, there you go. No need to make anything up there. It's all in the letters, I would have thought.
Absolutely.
Okay, that's Eva Welsh there speaking to us about his upcoming book, but the one that he was telling us most about, his current publication, The Last Day at Bowen's Court. It's published by Somerville Press. Turn inside. is a song called Cars in Space from a band called Rolling Blackouts Coastal Fever from an album called Sideways to a New Italy, and that is one of three albums we will be reviewing on Friday night's programme. Andrés Neumann is one of the leading writers in contemporary Spanish literature, an award-winning author of five novels, short stories and a travel book about Latin America. He spent his childhood in Buenos Aires before moving with his family to Granada in Spain. Fracture is novel number six, the tale of Yoshi Watanabe, a successful electronics executive who has spent most of his life abroad and returns to Japan in retirement. But there's more to the story than that, not least the fact that as a child, Yoshi survived both atomic bombs in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Andrés Neumann joins me now from Granada. It's an extraordinary detail in the life of this, I presume, fictional character, Yoshi Watanabe, that he should survive both of those bombs. There's actually a term for it, Andrés.
Yes. Well, it's a pleasure to talk to you and thank you for having me. Yes. You know, I was always very, very interested in Japan and in the so-called faraway cultures, because I think that a bit of a distance sometimes helps to understand your own identity. And I was reading about the Fukushima accident, and I read two things that struck me really hard. The first thing was learning that the axis of the planet shifted. The whole planet's axis shifted by a few centimeters as the whole planet was feeling the tremor of the earthquake that preceded the Fukushima disaster and the tsunami. And the second thing was reading about an amazing character who indeed survived the two bombs, a double hibakusha, they say it in Japan. And it was a man who actually lived for 90 years old, and he did survive both bombs. So I thought, well, nature was wise, because that man who really existed never saw the Fukushima accident. And I wonder what would have been he feeling and thinking if he witnessed actually this accident. So I invented a character who was half a tribute to this man and half a fictional character who lives in many countries and have to do as well with my own life, of course.
And the hibakusha, the people who did survive both bombs, there was an attitude in Japan subsequent to that, that they should be silenced, that their testimony should not be shared with anybody else. What was the reasoning behind that, and how does that feed into the story you tell in the book?
Well, you know, victims of anything really serious have to deal not only with what happened to them, but as well to the problem of how to communicate their trauma. It's very well researched now how people who come from a war or from any kind of limit situation, instead of being full of experiences to share, they come lacking words, unable to express what happened because they are not anymore like the rest of the people. In this case, there was, of course, humiliation, national humiliation, so nobody wanted to learn about people who reminded them their defeat. So I kind of researched the pattern behind different kind of victims in different countries, my country, Argentina, in Spain after the civil war, in my born country, Argentina, after the coup d'etat and the dirty war. And I found that there were similarities in the way that these victims found it hard to express trauma. And I invented this character, Mr. Watanabe, whose name is a tribute to a Peruvian poet, José Watanabe, to try to convey all those conflicts in just one kind of super character embodying many, many different cases.
And in those various cases that you mentioned to us, you know, when we're talking about, say, for example, the situation in your own country of Argentina, or when we're talking about the man-made bombs in Japan at the end of the First World, or at the end of the Second World War, I beg your pardon, or in one of the cases of the stories we're told were in Paris in and around the time of the 1968 riots. These are man-made events. Do you think the trauma caused by those is different from the trauma caused by the earthquake, which is a geological event, a natural event, if you like, but which can actually shift the Earth's axis, as you said? How different is the trauma that those events might cause?
Well, it's interesting because precisely the difference between the natural disaster and the human disaster are very often omitted. And the tricky thing with the last Japanese tragedy is that they were kind of mingled, because there was a natural disaster, the earthquake and the tsunami, but the nuclear accident was not only bad luck, because the tsunami hit the nuclear power station, and all the Japanese economy is strongly based in nuclear energy, and being the only inhabited country that suffered nuclear bombs is a kind of amazing thing to think about, how human cultures are very able to self-destruct and self-rebuild on and on. And so I thought that this Japanese case was a metaphor for the ability that any other country has to mix this inability to learn from what happened, and at the same time to be quickly able to recover.
The story, just to come back to the novel and the way in which you tell the novel, you know, effectively what we get is Yoshi's story, or Mr. Watanabe's story, told over six decades, five different time zones, and four love affairs. The four love affairs are interesting to my reader's mind in this case. Mm. Four love affairs, four different women, four different time frames, four different parts of the world. But we hear Watanabe's, or Yoshi's, story as told through the eyes of these women. Is this a reversal of the idea of male gaze, and you're giving us the female gaze on the male character?
Yes, I agree with that. You know, rather than female characters typically observed and described, and even worse, explained from a male point of view, I found it interesting to attempt the opposite. A silent, enigmatic man who is remembered, fantasized, and told from strong female perspectives. But this narrative choice is also kind of a metaphor of how we sometimes find it hard to express our most important or most painful feelings. So I suppose that sometimes we need the people we love to learn about our own story. And I was very interested in the notion of love experience not just as an adventure for young and beautiful people, you know, this advertisement, endless advertisement that sometimes love looks like on the screens, but as a form of art which takes our whole life to understand. That was something that I was eager to explore in Fracture by telling, as you said, not only four different love stories, but at four different ages as well. So in a way, the whole novel is a meditation on the stages and changes of our love experiences while time goes by.
There's another Japanese art form, if I'm correct in calling it an art form, kintsugi. You might explain what exactly that is, and it feeds into this idea of rebuilding that is there throughout the novel.
Absolutely, and it's beginning with a cover, which is a kind of a tribute to the kintsugi technique, because it's like a different bits of the story that are glued by the gold powder. Yes, the kintsugi is a very moving approach to life. Kintsugi is a technique that Japanese craftsmen use to repair objects, and instead of hiding the cracks, they show them by using gold powder in order to emphasize the places where the object was broken. And the incredible thing about this is that once this piece has been repaired, its value is higher than before. So according to this art philosophy, we are more valuable and we are more beautiful after surviving a kind of crack of a fracture. So the point of the novel was trying to apply this idea to people, love relationships, and even politics.
I suppose no less a person than Leonard Cohen told us, didn't he, that it's the cracks that let the lights come in. I guess that's what I keep calling him Yoshi and Mr. Watanabe. I'm not quite sure which to call him, really. But
both, depending on what degree of intimacy you've had with him.
I know him reasonably well, I think, at this time. But through the eyes of four other people, it has to be said, and you. To what extent does he actually, is that what the journey he sends himself on? He has to accept those cracks. He has to accept that the light, that is actually what will make him whole, to rebuild himself in that way.
Yeah, exactly. Because, you know, there's usually a kind of dichotomy we are educated in, the dichotomy between looking back or you know, moving forward and going ahead without looking back. Even the mythology has stories about the danger of looking back, right? But when you think about Kintsugi, both things happen at the same time. In order to be rebuilt and have a future, you do need to accept what happened, to know what's been broken. If you don't think about it, you will never be repaired. So I think that's a message of hope, I think, about our capacity of reconstructing the present and look into the future without ever denying our past. And what happens to Mr. Watanabe without going into much spoilers is that he decides to make a last trip to the most risky and dangerous area after the accident, in order to maybe gather his own pieces, his own childhood pieces, and put them all together.
Can you explain to me the character of York, or Jorge, I suppose he is, Pinedo, an Argentinian journalist, and you were born in Buenos Aires, even though you now live in Spain, who interviews the women, or tries to get in touch with the women to find out more about Watanabe? It sounds like an author who might be trying to get in touch with his characters.
Yes, you're right. And the novel is constantly toying with the relationships between a real story and an invented, a fictional story. So the same way that Mr. Watanabe is half invented and half an anthology of victims in different places, as I told you before, the whole novel pretends to be a research on things, real stories, although most of them are invented. So I needed a fictional journalist trying to work this out. And this Pinedo, you know, is more or less my age, and he was born in Argentina. So he kind of represents the link between the different generations and how these experiences have so much to teach us. So, you know, the people my generation were born in a dictatorship while the coup d'etat just happened. So I was really a small child when the dictatorship was going on in my country. So I do and don't remember it well. That affected deeply to my family, to my parents, half of my family exiled, part of my family was tortured or disappeared. But at the same time, I was too young to remember. So my generation kind of need to research their own memories in order to make this story belong to us too. And that was Pinedo does in the novel.
Yeah, and to a certain extent, there is an Argentinian section within the novel itself, but I'm wondering, is that a bit of Kintsugi that you will have to perhaps carry out in further artworks, in further books that you might write in the future, where you will have to revisit that period to put yourself back together? Is there some part of your identity that you think you will have to express in that way by exploring that part of difficult history for you?
Absolutely, there's my own displacement at play. Mr. Watanabe is a kind of super experiment of migrant culture, and I feel I do belong to that migrant culture. I was raised in two different continents, and I do belong and don't belong. I am and not a foreigner in both shores. So it's something that I'm constantly thinking about. But you know, the opposition between the global and the local is nowadays really outdated, I think, because we do live both ways. We live and think in the local and in the global, and I try to write that way. There's also, of course, different visions of the global from the local. So we're in one place and everywhere, and nowadays more than any other moment, because we're, you know, stuck at home trying to watch the entire world. And so I think that the writing should try to accompany this paradox of being nowhere and everywhere.
Finally, Andres, you're in Granada in Spain at the moment, and obviously Spain has had a particularly difficult time in recent months with COVID-19 and coronavirus. How is the rebuilding process happening? Mm. How do you see it happening there at the moment? What is the mood where you are?
Well, Spain is a country which loves fighting. I guess that the civil war has left subtle scars, which no kintsugi craftspeople have intended to repair, really. So we are not particularly united now, and that worries me. But at the same time, the solidarity of the people have been overwhelming, and people are really trying to take care of each other. But one important thing to point out is that, again, trying to build a future relies on the capacity of accepting that we made mistakes with the healthcare system. And as someone said about Britain, too, I think, besides, you know, clapping the healthcare workers, we should give them better tools for the next time, and respecting them more, not only, you know, with our love or gratitude, but giving them, you know, good salaries, good working conditions, because that is taking care of the other people too.
Andreas Neumann there speaking to me about his latest novel, Fracture, which is published by Granta. And that's our lot for this evening on Arena. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields research. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Andrew Kinn was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Olin McGowan. Talk to you tomorrow night once again, 7 o'clock here on RTE Radio 1.